Welcome to another flash edition of Musonomics, supported by Luminate. In New York, I'm Larry Miller from the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt.
And also in New York, I am Lynn Gonzalez, partner at the law firm of Granderson Desrochers. On this episode, we're going to talk about Live Nation and the DOJ, that impending lawsuit, J-Lo and the Black Keys canceling their arena tours, what is going on there, the Queen catalog may trade for $1 billion with a B, and another Spotify price hike.
So what's going on, Lynn, besides the headlines this week?
Oh, man, I'm living the dream. I actually just got back from California, where I was hanging out with my partners at GDR, celebrating the 5th year anniversary of the firm. So I want to give a big shout out to those guys. Congratulations on building something so awesome.
Congratulations, GDR. I kind of feel like, didn't they just start this?
5 years flies when you're having fun, you know?
I guess so. So let's dive in.
Let's do it.
So I've been thinking a lot about the Live Nation DOJ antitrust suit that has been out there for about a week and a half or so. And thinking about it or talking about it, I think it's useful to go back to 2009, 2010, when the Obama DOJ approved the merger of Live Nation and Ticketmaster. Back then, the regulators foresaw an era that would be, if not defined, at least marked by brutal competition that would be clearly enabled by the combination of the most successful concert promoter with the largest ticketing service. I mean, who thought that there would be a problem with that? And of course, that vision has largely come true. But there's more competition now in primary ticketing than there was before the merger. Ticketmaster has actually lost market share. And that's even before you consider the creation and massive growth of this enormous secondary ticketing market that has really reshaped the competitive landscape, which is why there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect between the DOJ's case that it served Live Nation under the Sherman Act, alleging anti-competitive behavior that hurts artists and fans, and the potential remedy of potentially reversing the merger that it previously approved, possibly causing Live Nation Entertainment to spin off Ticketmaster or some other construct that is at least a possible remedy in this case. So, as you might imagine, Live Nation's competitors are cheering. After all, their business model at Live Nation has been characterized by Michael Rapino, the company's CEO, as a flywheel spinning ever faster. And the company has executed well. And fans are cheering, too. After all, who hasn't been frustrated by impossibly long online queues? But to me, breaking up Live Nation Entertainment, undoing the merger and separating the concert promotion and the ticketing business will do absolutely nothing to lower ticket prices for fans, if that is even a goal of the DOJ. I mean, fans love to hate Ticketmaster, but artists and their teams set ticket prices, not Ticketmaster, and venues set fees, not Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster, to its credit, has for decades now pretty quietly absorbed the ire of fans while implementing the business model of artists and the venue's pricing strategy. And they do it at scale, and they do it fast. And for that, they get like in the range of 5 to 7% of the ticket price for all the services that they provide. That's it. Unlike the secondary digital marketplaces like, for example, StubHub, which gets an average of 37% commission rate. And naturally, out of that, they are not paying acts. They are not renting venues. They are not doing anything other than operating a secondary marketplace. I think the secondary market, which somebody recently estimated at like a $22 billion business worldwide, is actually driving pricing in the primary market. Artists want to play for real fans, and they frequently underprice tickets in the primary market in order to have real fans be able to sit in those seats. But the massive resale market, I think, has disrupted the industry's basic supply and demand challenges. So instead of real fans racing to get tickets to a favorite artist tour, they have to compete with millions of secondary market bots that hoover up ticket inventory to the most popular shows and then resell them at a multiple of face value. Look, if lawmakers and regulators are genuinely interested in making ticket prices more affordable for fans, they should consider regulating the secondary market like they do in parts of Europe and Australia. Lynn, your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the DOJ is saying that part of their concern is the ticket prices, so we have to take them at their word. And Live Nation may be running the flywheel and limiting access to venues, which is making the case for working with them a bit harder, and it makes it harder for competitors to operate. Pollstar mentioned that Live Nation's net profits last year were just 1.4%, which doesn't really demonstrate monopolistic profits. But the argument is that they're using their revenues that they're gaining, you know, they're gaining in the ticket arena to reinvest into the promotion business and outspend competitors to lock in artists. You know, even if all that is true, those things are problematic and, you know, give them arguably an unfair advantage. But it, again, does absolutely nothing to address access to tickets or the secondary market or getting actual fans in the door. If the goal is to reduce ticket prices to the consumers or increase the access to tickets, you're 100% right. I don't see how the suit accomplishes that.
I have actually read the suit. And look, it's not like it makes no sense at all whatsoever. I mean, we have all experienced what it is like to stand in line, either a physical line or over the last 10 or 15 years, a virtual line, and think that you're going to get a ticket to the Taylor Swift show or whatever it is, and then, you know, not. That's pretty frustrating. Now, does that merit a hearing in the United States Senate? You know, does that merit a class action suit of a bunch of moms of Taylor Swift fans? I don't know. Maybe she is a precedent-breaking artist. But to merit this DOJ litigation, I just don't get it.
Speaking of tours.
Yeah, so maybe you heard or read that Jennifer Lopez canceled her arena tour this week.
I did.
Yeah. Now, don't worry, Lynn, you can return your tickets and, you know, Ticketmaster will return your money. But actually, the J-Lo tour wasn't the only arena tour that canceled this week for whatever reason, although she said it's to spend time with the friends and family. Well, I'd like to spend more time with friends and family. But let's assume that the cancellation happened because ticket sales were super, super soft. But the Black Keys canceled an entire North American leg of their arena tour this week with no explanation. That was after having a successful tour in Europe this year and playing great venues like the Brixton Academy in London and the Zenith in Paris. And Chris Black wrote in GQ about this, a very thoughtful article. And what he said was that arena tours used to be sustained by early ticket sales. Like if you were big enough to play in an arena, you were gonna either sell out immediately or sell out very early on in the on sale. And he pointed to a Twitter account that is at @underfacevalue, which tracks price drops and undersold shows and other peculiarities across the ticketing system. And in fact, their mantra is the hashtag it pays to wait, or rather just pays to wait. And in fact, if you'd waited for the right moment, you could have seen the Rolling Stones in Seattle for $29 or 21 Savage in Chicago for $19. And that maybe for the acts, it's better to play a packed theater for two or three nights, like say in New York, the Beacon or Radio City or now the Brooklyn Paramount. And fans have a better experience in theaters. And what band or what act wouldn't want to play a sold-out hall rather than a, you know, a half or two-thirds empty arena? So who's at fault for all these canceled arena dates? Live Nation? AEG? The artist teams? Can we blame it on the algorithm? Lynn, what do you think?
I think there's a lot of things to blame it on, but my inclination is to blame it on maybe ego or optimism. I mean, you say that the choice is between playing a half-empty arena or a packed theater. I think they're thinking they're going to be able to pack out these arenas because they're seeing consumption of their music, you know, streaming consumption that maybe suggests their audience is bigger than it is. But once you have to have fans pluck down actual dollars, post-tax dollars, to buy those tickets, maybe they don't want to spend it on your big show. So it's an adjustment. We got to get a better understanding of consumption for paying customers as opposed to those who are just streaming casually. the economy. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on right now. There's a lot of reasons why people may not want to pluck down the big bucks for these shows.
And speaking of the big bucks.
The big bucks, the Queen catalog. Yeah, Sony and another investor are in talks to buy the Queen catalog at a rumored price of $1 billion. The deal would include all songs, as well as logos, videos, merch, pub, and any other business opportunities. It's worth noting that Disney, through Hollywood Records, controls rights to their masters in North America, so that creates a little wrinkle. And, you know, their lead singer died in 1991, so the bulk of their albums are up for potential reversions, too, so that's something interesting to keep an eye on. But it's reported that the band controls the rest of the world and all publishing rights, which is super helpful in this sort of transaction. If this happens, it'll be the biggest deal of its kind, and Sony's been taking some big swings. I mean, this sale would be double what Sony paid for Springsteen's catalog in 2021. Springsteen, by comparison, had 20 million monthly Spotify listeners. Sony also acquired a 50% interest in Michael Jackson's music for 600 million. He had 41 million monthly Spotify listeners. Queen is immensely popular even now. Their Spotify following is up to 52 million monthly listeners, and they're bigger than both Michael Jackson and Bruce Springsteen, as I've just mentioned. In fact, their first greatest hits album is the most popular LP of all time in the UK, selling over 7 million copies. In 2023, it was still a top 20 selling record in the UK, beating new releases by like Ed Sheeran and the Rolling Stones. It's an amazing deal. I have to think that Bohemian Rhapsody and the release of that movie really amplified the catalog and created the perfect storm for such an amazing potential sale.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be driven by the lightning rod that was the success of the film, which I think was unprecedented. But I'm not even sure that number of online streams at Spotify or any place else is driving the valuation metrics, right? I mean, if you're looking at the financial performance of the sound recordings and the underlying music composition rights, as well as other name, image, likeness, and other rights that are going to be bundled in with this, that the analysis would bear out that it is worth what an informed buyer is willing to pay. And if this does happen, it will be the first billion-dollar single-artist catalog deal that actually got done. And I remember a year or so ago when the Pink Floyd catalog was in the market, and that deal ended up not getting done, and it was rumored to be shopped at $1 billion. But this one looks like it's actually going to happen.
Yeah, I think I was just taken aback by just how immense their popularity still is today. Speaking of Spotify users.
So Spotify is raising their prices again after not having raised their prices at all over their more than first 10 years. So Lucas Shaw wrote in his Bloomberg column, not just about the price increases, but about an important stat that is used to manage all maturing subscription-based online network services, whatever they are, whether we're talking about wireless carriers or streaming services. And that stat is the churn rate. Now, the churn rate is the percentage of subscribers who discontinue a service over a period of time. And as it turns out, Spotify listeners are the least likely to cancel among the major audio or video streaming services in the U.S., according to a report that Lucas wrote about from the research firm Antenna. And the number is surprisingly low. Fewer than 1.5% of Spotify subs churned during the month of April, and the company's monthly churn rate has hovered around 2% all year. That is super low. I mean, Netflix is at about 2%, so, you know, the rates are kind of comparable. And he goes on to write about the fact that there are really two key reasons for Spotify's success. One is a thing that applies to all audio streaming services, and that customers switch audio services about a fourth as often as they switch between video services. Now, on the one hand, audio services are undifferentiated. Pretty much everybody has pretty much all the same catalog, right? They all offer 100 million or more songs sorted into albums and playlists, and some of them have a lot of podcasts. That lack of differentiation is a big reason why I think Spotify and the other services have been kind of scared to raise prices over the last 10 years or so, at least up until last year. And that there was always the fear that if Spotify costs more than, say, Apple Music or Amazon or YouTube Music, that people would just switch. But as it turns out, that's not true. If all the music services raise prices at pretty much the same time as they did last year, it may not be true at all. Audio services like Spotify seem to be stickier than it would appear. And the reason seems to be that users have dozens, or in my case, hundreds of playlists within their preferred service, creating switching costs. And so if you were to move, as our producer and pal Lars Murray did last year, from one service to another, you would be spending, I don't know, months switching between services and recreating your playlists on the new service. So this is good news for the music industry, which wants the companies to raise prices because this is good for them. And in fact, after a successful price increase last year, Spotify plans to do it again this year.
I like the idea of shifting away from like the free tiers, and I support the idea that music should not be free to the consumer. You know, I get wary of raising prices too much, but I do think it's been a healthy boost for the industry, and we'll take those dollars while we can get them.
I've been loving what Rob Abelow has been writing in his blog, Where Music's Going, and we have to get him here on the pod. But he wrote this week that all we've ever known over the last dozen years or so since Spotify launched in the U.S. and other major markets outside Scandinavia around the world has been about growth. It's been a big growth story. One low price, all the songs in the world, same experience for everyone. And subscriptions grew year after year after year after year. And the growth accelerated year after year until 2019. But growth has been slowing for the last 5 years. In fact, Spotify's growth has slowed from almost 29% annual growth in 2019 to about 6% in 2023. Rob says that there are four changes coming for streaming that are a result of this, like, massively decelerating growth. And some of it's already here, right? Like price hikes. So we've been discussing price hikes at Spotify. A stronger push to move free users to paid. And Rob did the math and says that a Spotify premium user was worth 13 times a free one in terms of the amount of revenue that they generate in just the first quarter this year. And in fact, they just quietly put lyrics behind the paywall. And Sony just called for an end to free music streaming altogether. Rob says that it should be probably not more than 3 months free, and then after that, require something like $4 a month for ad-supported streaming. And that sounds sensible to me. He also says that, you know, no more one-size-fits-all. Previously, everybody would subscribe to pretty much the same service, and that there were lower prices to get more people in, like, you know, a lot of people got in on family deals or student deals. But now there are music-only tiers. There is the Music Plus audiobooks tier that we unpacked here on the pod. Maybe a Music Pro add-on that could be a super premium tier. And by the way, I'm still waiting for the high bitrate Spotify streaming service. Like, please offer that pretty soon. I'd be happy to give them, I don't know, another $10 a month if they only did that. And also chasing new kinds of revenue, too. Spotify has been aggressively going after monetizing all of this listener attention and actually selling it back to artists and labels through their Marquee and Showcase program, and further evidencing the two-sided marketplace that Spotify is, because it creates and collects a whole ton of data about artists and music and also music consumption. And they've been selling that data back to artists and labels. And then finally, they're getting a lot more aggressive about cash management and actually becoming profitable. And we have spoken previously on the pod about how just a year or two ago, Spotify was pursuing growth. And now they, I think, as a result of new demands that the capital markets are putting on them, needs to just make the business model viable. It needs to be sustainable. In other words, the company needs to get consistently profitable. And that is what they are focused on now. And I am sure that that is the thing that drove the whole discussion about bundling music with audiobooks so that they could pay a lower rate to songwriters and music publishers for the music that they play on the service and skirt the regulated mechanical royalty rate that they are obligated to pay as a standalone service. But my favorite thing, though, is how Rob talks about the enshittification of Spotify.
Sir, what? The what? Enshittification?
Enshittification of Spotify. Yeah, so here's how enshittification works. And this, by the way, was coined by Cory Doctorow. He is super smart about the evolution of network services. And here is enshittification as Cory Doctorow defines it. First, network services are really good to their users. Think about like the beginning of Facebook and the beginning of Google and even the beginning of Spotify. Really, really good to their users in the beginning. Then they abuse their users to make things better for their business customers because they need a business model. Finally, they abuse the business customers to claw back all of the value for themselves. And then sometimes they die.
That's the digital services circle of life, Larry.
I guess so. But, you know, this is what happens when platforms change the way that they allocate value, combined with the nature of the two-sided market, which Spotify and the other digital music services, and in fact, almost every network service that we can think of relies on to prosecute their business model, raking off an ever larger share of the value that passes between the sides. So there you have it. Enshittification 101.
Right, where both sides are held hostage and then the service dies.
There you go.
Yeah, I worry about the two-sided marketplace approach if it's just a way to further segment the market and monetize consumers and just take every dollar out of both sides, right? It means everybody's unhappy with the service and the relationship that's being had. And then I worry about, you know, over-monetizing the consumers and segmenting the streaming market so much so that the only artists that are ever supported or that you can really commit to are those who are super fans, right? If I've got to pay for every bit of access to artists that I'm into, I'm only going to pay for a limited number. So I think that maybe has the potential to close off, you know, our streaming universe. So I do worry about that.
But don't forget that Spotify is in the audio services business only, period, full stop. Apple is in the device business. Amazon is in the sell everything business, and neither one of them needs to rely on a profitable music service in order to sustain their overall business model.
Busy week on all these economic topics.
It has been, and it's going to be a busy week this next week in New York as we kick off New York Music Month with our annual conference with the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment here at NYU Steinhardt, followed by a whole bunch of other stuff. It's Indie Week, A2IM Indie Week next week, and the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and the Music Investor Conference. And I think Larry and Lars are doing the Smartest People in the Room thing later this week.
Oh, I can't wait to hear that one.
I know you can't.
I'll be ready to learn.
Secrets will be revealed.
Well, I wish you guys both luck with that.
Thanks, Lynn.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. It's always a pleasure to be here.
From the Music Business Program at NYU Steinhardt, I'm Larry Miller.
And from GDR, I'm Lynn Gonzalez.
This Musonomics podcast was executive produced by Lars Murray, technical production by Isaac Gaines. And if you like what you heard, we don't care. No, actually, we do care. Please share the episode with a friend and be sure to follow us wherever you got your pods so you don't ever miss a new episode. And while you're at it, please give us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Pods. It really helps. Once again, thank you to our friends at Luminate for their support of this episode. And finally, thank you for listening. See you next time.